It is kind of funny that we're doing all these podcasts and just we've been a man down like every single episode for the past 4 weeks.
Yeah, it's
it feels like longer.
It's been rough.
Donald Trump addressed Congress this week, ushering in a new golden era for America. The stunning and brave Democrats color-coordinate their outfits. The resistance is back, baby.
It is.
Color-coordinated outfits. That'll get them.
Trump's over now.
Yeah.
They finally got him.
They got him.
Before we get into everything, don't forget to smash the like button, subscribe to wherever you're listening to us on, follow us on X, hit the notification bell on YouTube, leave us a review on Spotify, leave us a nice and kind review. Otherwise, it hurts our feelings.
Please, yeah. And we got with us today Bennett and Kyle, of course, your host David Rand, and Joe's not here. He's currently in D.C. for a very important appointment, celebrating a new executive order for Irish American Month. Joe, what do you have to say?
Well, oh, sorry. We can't hear you, Joe.
His hair's getting long.
Here, actually, so there's some important news, probably one of the most important executive orders that have come in from Trump this cycle. Here is what is going on in D.C. right now. Thank you, Joe, for all your brave work.
And to just honor all of the Irish Americans, and I'm a little bit biased because I'm American and Irish, but...
Well, great people.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, sir.
And they voted for me in heavy numbers, so I like them even more. You're not supposed to, but you have to like that. So for the Irish American people, proclamation.
So
proclamation.
So what is it? This month and this month alone is Irish American History Heritage
Month. Yeah, just March 2025.
Nice, Irish people. Good luck.
Best thing they've gotten since independence. You know, right there.
I should have brought
this is Potato Month.
Should have brought fucking Guinness in. Damn it!
Big potato up. Let's go.
Big. See, it's always Big Potato. Big Potato is at the center of everything. Can never trust Big Potato.
It's the best conspiracy theory. Step aside, Jews. We got the Irish at you.
That is for the skiff this week, where we will be talking about that. Now this is Big Potato episode.
Yeah, this is Big Potato. Save that for the skiff, which is going to be a lockdown skiff. So if you want to see all the stuff going on with the Israel dialogue right now, which there's been a lot. It's kind of come out of the blue. We're going to be talking about that in the skiff, but you got to subscribe to see it. That one's not going public.
Yeah, the skiff is our members-only content. If you are a paying member, you get to see what's locked down and behind closed doors. Things get crazy in there.
If you are a small business owner looking for exponential growth, you have to connect with Adam Thune at Intellectual Patriots. He will revolutionize your business game and help you get to the next level. Adam can streamline your business practices and advertising strategies to improve your bottom line. His expertise in data engineering means he can build you the systems you need to collect and analyze market data. His mission is to provide you with invaluable insights to fuel your success. From grant writing and business proposals to digital systems integrations, even AI management, Intellectual Patriots is a one-stop shop for cutting-edge solutions. Don't wait another second. Visit intelpatriots.com to learn more. That's intelpatriots.com. This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
This week we had State of the Union address, but it wasn't called the State of the Union address. It was just a speech to Congress.
I don't think it was technically a State of the Union address. I mean, technically...
I think the first year of every presidency is technically not a State of the Union address because he hasn't been in yet or something.
There's a constitutional requirement for the president to address Congress at a certain rate. I can't remember exactly what it is, but in this case, I don't think it was for that. It wasn't to qualify the constitutional requirement. Therefore, it wasn't a State of the Union.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just a Trump speech before Congress, which they can call in order to basically, and this is supposed to be the way British Parliament works, where you have a, at least that's, it's kind of inspired by that, where you have the prime minister gets up and has to justify their leadership before Congress. And it got out of hand really quickly.
Yeah, it was like 3 minutes in.
Yeah.
Was where it got started getting out of hand. We had, what was it, Senator Al Green?
Yeah.
Is that his name? Mm-hmm. Angrily raising his cane and having to be kicked out. And here is what that looks like.
Members are directed to uphold and maintain decorum in the House and to cease any further disruptions. That's your warning. Members are engaging in willful and continuing breach of decorum, and the chair is prepared to direct the sergeant-at-arms to restore order to the joint session.
He didn't even do it at like a particularly controversial time. He just kind of did it right like, off the bat.
Right at the beginning.
He's like, I don't want to be here. Eject me, please.
Mr. Green, take your seat. Take your seat, sir. Take your seat.
He refuses to take a seat.
Finding that members continue to engage in willful and concerted disruption of proper decorum, the chair now directs the sergeant-at-arms to restore order.
Vance kind of has an aura to him.
Remove this gentleman from the chamber.
It's kind of like bodyguard aura.
Second best cane move in Congress.
I was just looking it up. I was like, I know this story.
I was actually holding that because I couldn't remember the story specifically.
It's,
That's the formation of the Republican Party, wasn't it?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Hell yeah, brother.
Yeah, so he gets escorted out.
How much do I bet it's a sword cane?
Sword cane. Ready for those? He's ready for duels to be brought back. Bring back public dueling. Yeah, so there's kind of this. So public sentiment. I saw a CNN poll that said that 80% of watchers found this inappropriate of Senator Al Green.
On CNN?
Yeah, that's the CNN poll.
Yeah. Which,
although it was conducted by like a third party outlet.
Sure.
It was like broadcast on CNN. And what I have found generally of public sentiment, and I'd be curious in your guys' thoughts, is overall impression of Trump at it, pretty high. Mm-hmm. Overall impression of the Democrats, very low. Like the Democrats looking kind of weak and pathetic.
You mean this specifically?
This event specifically. Like not just the Senator Al Green, like this being inappropriate, but just like the event as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Trump was very high approval on there, and then the Democrats as a whole was very like, they look weak and loser-like.
Yeah, I mean, holding up signs and color coordinating your outfits, when you're the party out of power and you had that big of a defeat, it's hard to look strong at all when you are weak.
Musk lies.
Yeah,
right. False.
Yeah. They're also spending all their time defending the institutions that everyone's sick and tired of and elect Donald Trump to do something about. So, you know, I don't think the general public understood just how corrupt and ridiculous USAID is. Mm-hmm. But the exposure of it and the exposure of that is tremendously popular. So them defending it is just a losing position. I don't think they're winning themselves any favors overall. And then on top of that, they have a, you know, their entire strategy is just not going to. I mean, it's hard to look good when you have Trump with the microphone in front of you saying all the great things he's doing.
Yeah, I did see.
Clap for the kid.
Yeah. And I want to get into that too.
That was
I did see polling on this. This came from CBS News / a YouGov poll. Mm-hmm. 77% of people support his ban to cut government waste and spending, like of watchers. This is coming from like verified
the government
watchers.
Employees, Kyle. The government employees. They'll have to find a new job.
77% back his immigration and border policies. 76% approve of Trump's speech. 76% approve of removing congressmen who interrupted his speech. 74% say his speech was presidential. 73% support his stance on Russia and Ukraine. 68% say it made them feel hopeful and proud of the country. 68% say he has a clear plan to tackle inflation. 68% say he accurately describes American crime crisis. Mm. And 63% say he's focused on issues that they care about.
I think that those check out. It's hard to find anything that 70% of the public agrees with.
Yeah.
Now, 60% you can get to, but 70%, that's rare.
There is a bit of a granted. This is coming from watchers of it, yeah. And this probably skews towards people that are supportive of Trump. So they're like,
on CNN though?
No, but,
oh, that watched the
actual because they're polling people that watched it, and that I think that number skews 10% in Trump's favor of like people that are more supportive of Trump is like it was like 10-15%. So like those numbers are going to be skewed and slanted because of that. Mm-hmm. But still, I think overall it is one of those things where I feel like I've never really seen numbers like this from a State of the Union address in the past.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think overall it was a well done event by the Trump team. I mean, they brought up, you know, compelling emotional cases. You know, in general, these are sales pitches. They're kind of you know, post campaign pitches for your administration's decisions.
Always be rallying.
Yeah, right. That's the
Trump right. Never stop rallying.
And it did have a campaign rally esque experience. I mean, he didn't stick to the teleprompter 100%. He had some funny jokes in there. You know, about the like Doge exposure of Social Security information of people who live too long and saying to Kennedy, you know, America's healthier than we thought.
Meanwhile, the Democrats are holding up false. Yeah. That's not true. Yeah. And you're like, the records are there. We can see them.
Well, and knowledge is not true. Is like, once again, you're just defending absurdity, things that people already know. Is the government inefficient and bad with technology? Well, have you ever been to the DMV? You know, I mean, like, it's not.
Well, that's an interesting, because a sentiment that I'm seeing beginning to be thrown around, and maybe it's not beginning, but it's been there, is that the American public at large, like 70-75%, is supportive of cutting waste, fraud, and abuse and kind of the DOGE efforts. Yep. But there's a sentiment that's being, and this is a good narrative ploy that's being put out by the Democrats, like is that it's bad optics for the world's richest man to be the one leading the charge on that. And mm-hmm. they're really trying to push the world's richest man is leading the charge, and that's bad.
Right.
Despite the actual public at large being supportive of the, so that's the subversive trying to undercut it thing.
So what I predict is the Democrats' next messaging technique is to say, this is the gilded era, not the golden era, the gilded, right? It's actually just painted over gold. It's not really truly there. Mm-hmm. And they're going to rely on the meme of the history course that everyone took in high school that says, oh, in that era, what we're talking about is the, you know, before the progressive era, that 1880s to 1910s era was defined by increased inequality that, you know, where the captains of industry were running everything, and it was a terrible, awful time for your average American, which is bullshit. And we should do a skiff on the Gilded Era sometime. Yeah, that'd be fun.
That would be interesting.
So that's the strategy we've talked about a little bit of trying to separate Elon from Trump by driving down Elon's numbers functionally. Even though, and it's funny because their whole argument rests on, has he done anything wrong? Illegal? No. But he could.
He could. He could do something wrong.
And you don't trust those rich people. And I get that. I understand the skepticism of the powerful. I mean, I especially the powerful combined with government force. But what he's done so far, I'm looking at it skeptically. And I think any observer who's trading fairly in what's actually happening has to come to the conclusion that what we're mostly talking about is, you know, exposure of waste, fraud, and abuse so far. I mean,
well, in the fraud, like just the sheer amount of like, because most of the things in the USAID side where it's like, oh, $50 million of condoms to whatever, like that's money laundering. They're not actually buying 50. Like that, like, and this is a declassified.
Hell yeah, brother.
Well, this is a lot of these things were declassified after JFK was, because JFK created USAID and it was supposed to be this like public works project of like spreading our stuff around the world. And it's kind of what like the vision that I think people thought USAID was.
Yeah.
But it's declassified. Like you can look at these documents of after JFK died, the CIA came in and purposely came in to use it for money laundering for their operations.
Yeah.
Like that's not crazy.
And it was used even during JFK's time as a cover for CIA operations in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Right. And we know this. Like that's
Cuba.
Proven.
Cuba too.
Yeah. So it's one of those things that things even that Democrats should be skeptical of, such as soft power projection and covert operations to overthrow democratically elected governments all over the world. should be the thing that they should be outraged about, but they're not. So they're actually weakening their own strong ideological side of the argument.
Some other areas too. I'm not going to pull up all the videos from it. I mean, if you've existed online, you've probably seen some of these. But other areas where the Democrats just looked kind of weak and pathetic is, well, actually, there's maybe a bigger narrative here. Is remember a time where at State of the Union addresses, you had like...
No one got kicked out?
Well, no one got kicked out, but also a time where both sides would clap for things that were kind of like non-controversial issues and things like that.
Yeah.
And then like the only time they wouldn't stand and clap was just like there'd be like three or four issues in over across the thing and they're like the most polarizing ones.
Yeah.
It's like we're not at that, we're not in that world anymore. Now it's just like whoever's in power, the other side just sits down the entire time and the other side claps.
And then they stare at
them.
Yeah.
Because in some of the things here was like there's some easy areas for the Democrats to get up and clap. One was the young kid with brain cancer, right?
Bad look.
It's a bad look to be like, Trump is doing this like kind of symbolic gesture for a young kid with brain cancer. His Secret Service guy, who's like always at his side, he was there during the shooting, gave him a badge and made him an honorary member because the kid really wants to be a police officer. And it's kind of like a powerful, fun, emotional thing. And Democrats, nope. Goes even as far as where you have people like Rachel Maddow and there's some other pundit that was going kind of viral of being like, this is destructive. Trump should be like it's how dare Trump use this kid as for his political ploys. It's like a
Biden State of the Union did the same fucking thing with some woman.
Yeah. And well, it's one of these things too, where like this is standard practice and I'm not personally a huge fan of the, like using people as props, but it's it's effective and it's what you do. It's like
it's just the hypocrisy.
There's other things. There was a high school girl who had her face smashed in by a male volleyball player in women's sports. That in itself is just like, nope, can't,
I understand that because it's so I don't understand it because like that's another 80-20 issue that the Democrats are just losing on.
Well, and that's the thing.
It's strategically dumb.
Trump, he's won all the 80-20 issues. Yeah. It's just like he's sitting there and he's like taking his issues and is like, wait, the other side's not for these? Okay, I'll take them, I guess. And they're just like such simple issues where it's like any politician, like it's such a political victory, be like, yeah, men and women, they're different. Yeah. Oh, crazy. Oh, no.
So I'm sure there are principled people on the other side of that issue. That said, it's just really bad politics at a minimum. Mm-hmm. Get up and clap for the kid with brain cancer at minimum. And, you know, for the other ones, if you can. No, I looked it up on Grok just now because I kept on thinking I needed to, but I never did. Reagan is the one who popularized using people in the crowd to tell individual stories.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. And it's just been a theme since then?
The great communicator. You know, it's a tactic, right? I mean, it's a tactic that he used that then, you know, George W. Bush uses and then Bill Clinton started to use and it's just spread because it's a solid, it works because...
Especially in the TV age, that's also where like people are still learning TV politics at that time. Mm-hmm. So like, that makes sense.
And you have a TV star as president, right? So he knows telling a compelling individual story is the way you win over the public when they're watching it. So I think it's and it worked in this case. I mean, there was also Lincoln Riley and the other gal, I forget her name, the high school girl, who were killed by illegal immigrants. And talking about the Lincoln Riley Act, and then he redesignated a nature reserve for the younger gal who tragically died from an attack from an illegal alien.
Yeah, and I also like one kind of final thing on the Democrats just like looking pathetic. I'm not going to play the video because like
spare our
ears for it.
Wait, but, and the cringe, you could die from the cringe of it.
But there was 30 different senators/congressmen who all put out essentially the same script on their videos, slight nuances different, but they all start off with like shit ain't true.
Yeah.
And like obviously this is
you're gonna get the Gen Z's with that.
Yeah.
You're saying like the naughty
normal
word.
Working class people, they say shit. You know, it's
like, trust me, all these senators and congressmen, when they're not on camera, cuss.
Hello, fellow kids.
They all do.
Exactly what this is.
You're right.
Oh, I gotta pull the video. Did you guys see I didn't have this in the notes. There was a video of all the women congressmen doing the Super Christ. Smash Bros
yeah,
thing.
Yeah. Oh, it's so cringe. It is so bad. While you're doing that, let me on one thing. The guy who got kicked out, the senator.
Al Green.
He did that, right? What is the motive, right? Because he nothing had really happened yet. He had just been introduced, right? So why do that? What is his motive for doing that? Because that was an intentional act to get kicked out.
Maybe he had to shit.
His depends were full.
Yeah.
Maybe. I would suspect what it really is a fundraising ploy, because now what he's going to do is he probably put out that, I mean, 20 minutes afterwards, Donald Trump kicked me out of Congress for standing up to his authoritarian dictatorship.
Do you know?
And he's going to get a bunch of money in from it. He's going to put it into his stuff. He's got this PAC is going to do the same thing. Yeah. They're gonna raise gobs of money on that.
Do you know when his reelection is?
No, I don't. It doesn't matter.
No, I know. I'm just wondering if it's
is it a midterm election
in 2 years?
The other, you know, if it's not always be rallying, it's also always be fundraising, right? So yeah. Okay, brace yourselves. We're going into the cringe.
I could have gone for the longer
Let's
one.
Let's do it.
No, thank
Can
God.
We just mute it, though? I mean, I don't... It's... Or just play it low. Oh, God.
If anyone's played Super lighting. Smash Bros., like, this is how all the characters kind of bounce.
Uh-huh.
And they this is the Super in. Smash Bros. Music.
She kind of added a little bit. That's...
Cringe.
God fucking damn it.
And you know what the DNC did? They're just like, we need to revivify our image. Let's get someone to get us on TikTok. We're gonna take them back. They have a two-pronged attack. One, Chris Cuomo not Chris Cuomo. What's his name?
Andrew?
The former governor of California.
Oh, Newsom.
Newsom has a podcast he launched. Mm-hmm. Yep. Right,
where he's just had a big interview with Charlie Kirk, which was kind of interesting. I haven't watched it. But
neither have I. I saw some of the clips.
Some clips, yeah.
It was interesting. It was interesting. A Democrat actually try to debate long form for once.
A bit like psyoping that's going on with him, though. Like, really? he's so Trudeau like. Like, everything about him just reminds me of Trudeau.
It's pretty false.
As a Canadian, I'm just like, ugh.
He's got Trudeau vibes.
Wait,
no way, no.
Newsom or Kirk? Okay.
Newsom.
Them.
No, Kirk actually came across pretty good.
Okay. I'm not going to listen to it. I'm not going to lie.
I'll get to it eventually. But I'm just saying, two-pronged attack. One, try to get into TikTok with your congressional delegations and try to, you know, revive the brand amongst young people. But once again, leading... I mean, this is the equivalent of... remember that John Tester thing with Cory Booker where they're tackling each other?
No, I don't remember that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Poor Cory Booker.
Yeah, right. Well, he never actually got to tackle him because John Tester couldn't get back up again. But
it's like a turtle.
Yeah.
No, that's Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, big boy.
Right.
Anyways, that kind of like trying to get to the youth thing by using meme culture sort of thing, and it's weird to watch the party that, as when I came into politics, was the trendy party fail. Like, and just get so cringe mm-hmm. in trying to outreach and try to get popular online.
Well, and that's the thing is, because like being memey and getting into like TikTok culture, that's smart. Mm-hmm. Like, that's actually smart.
It's tactical.
It's just how they're doing it is extremely cringe. And it's very like, it's like the corporate man trying to be like hip and with the crowd. It still has that energy to it where a lot of the Trumpian energy of all the influencers and all the people on that side, like they're kind of hip and they're with the new technology, right? Like,
right.
Like there's a different, the vibes are different right now.
And it's like, not coming across right. It's like remember when on Twitter before it went terrible before Elon bought it and made it better again, there was all the corporations were trying to get on Twitter and trying to advance messaging and be cool and hip, like the Wendy's.
It's literally the Steve Buscemi hello fellow kids.
It would be STFU brand.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like that.
But now a lot of corporations have actually kind of fixed that. Like they're paying six figures to social media guys to handle all their stuff.
It's gotten a lot better.
Yeah, I know some of the people in the crypto space that are very involved in that type of stuff.
And that could change.
They've kind of done like the community organizing, social media management, where like some of the corporations they've begun to do it so much better. But like it's not just like their original strategy is like just throw some money at it and they'll be like. But now it's like they're actually getting like really talented people on it.
And that could go to show you that this doesn't mean the Democrats are out forever. Right. right? Yeah, this I mean, just I means think they're trying to figure it out.
They're going to figure it out. It's just kind of funny watching their very bad attempts.
Yeah, do you guys have any thoughts on what the midterm? Because like traditionally, the midterms are always the party in power loses some power.
Yeah,
and currently,
I think it depends how fast they figure out this new messaging.
Yeah, currently with the way the vibes are going right now, like I even saw Elon tweet this as like. Somebody, it might have been like Mike Lee or someone saying that, like, I think that we might actually get like 60 in the Senate next go around. And Elon tweeted it as like after the state of the, or after this event, he tweeted that night, actually. Yeah. I think that that's probably true.
I think it depends on how, if Donald Trump can indeed navigate the trade war he's starting and inflation and tax cuts at the same time. And how he manages that is going to determine the midterms.
Yeah. I mean, a lot can happen in the next year. And a half.
It's still early. All right, so let's get into his actual comments rather than just what happened around it. We didn't start the clock. I have no idea how far we are in.
We're about 24 minutes
in. Nice. Well, we're flying by the seat of our pants. Let's go, boys.
So the first one right here is on the cartels.
Yes.
Is his comments.
Yes, and we're not doing it sequentially. We're doing it by interest in the issues here.
Here is Trump on cartels.
5 nights ago, Mexican authorities, because of our tariff policies being imposed on them, think of this, handed over to us 29 of the biggest cartel leaders in their country. That has never happened before. They want to make us happy. First time ever.
I think that's a win on my
bingo card. But we need Mexico and Canada to do much more than they've done, and they have to stop the fentanyl and drugs pouring into the USA. They're going to stop it. I have sent Congress a detailed funding request laying out exactly how we will eliminate these threats to protect our homeland and complete the largest deportation operation in American history, larger even than current record holder President Dwight D. Eisenhower, a moderate man, but someone who believed very strongly in borders. America.
Stop it there.
Yeah. Yeah. So interesting thing that's happening, right? So we theorize that the tariffs on Mexico had to do with trade balance. And there are some things that indicate that because he does keep a lot of the tariffs even after Mexico's capitulated here. Mm-hmm. Important to note. But that it had to do with the geostrategic, you know, aims of reducing fentanyl in the United States and reducing cartel presence on the border. I wonder to what degree what we're talking about with this is is it going to be as popular as he thinks it was going to be? I mean, it seems to be that way. Will that hold over the long run? He acknowledged one of the other people that he told the story of was a Border Patrol agent who covered a fellow agent under fire. And this is like, that's the sort of, you know, because the fickleness of politics is if you solve a problem, this is why problems don't get solved. If you solve a problem and we actually see reductions in immigration now, will that matter come this midterms is going to become, well, that's the new normal, right? And then people don't see what's good. They only see what's a problem. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So I wonder about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also just because this was one of the things that I had put on my bingo card is that there was going to be this joint effort between one side of the Mexican government and the Trump administration in trying to really handle the cartels and clean up the cartelization of the Mexican government and how much there is this just like total control. Because remember, we covered the story during the Mexican elections last year where it was something like 89, 90, something like that.
I mean, my head is 68, but it could be 86, something like that.
Something in the 80s sounds correct to me. People running for various... I see this misreported all the time. Every time people talk about it, they're always like, there was like 80 people running for president or something. No, that's not what it's different positions all around the Mexican government.
Assassinated.
Yeah, no, like I watched videos of some of these guys getting assassinated. Like I watched people coming up at people's events and just like shooting people in the back of the head. Like it's crazy.
Wow.
It was nuts.
Yeah.
So like the cleanup of Mexico is really interesting to me. And I'm curious on how these tariff tactics are going to work in helping that cleanup.
Well, there's another point. He actually claims that the cartels have total control over Mexico. Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, are you telling me, Kyle, that the climate scientists that they elected as president can't clean up the cartels? Is that what you're telling me?
That's right. She's a Jewish climate scientist. That's right. I forgot about that.
It's a strange moment, right? I mean, like, and you know, there was some pushback from the Mexicans. There's
it's also
responding
one of these,
tariffs.
It's also one
like
of these
that.
Interesting things where the president is like, she's not like a Catholic Mexican, which is what you would expect of Mexico. She's a Jewish climate scientist, like atheist type, right?
It's a different moment.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and there's
from
a history
cultural perspective
of
there that exists.
Jews in Mexico. It's not like she's completely out of the blue, but there and we covered that during the election last time.
I'd forgotten that.
I can't remember what episode it is, but I do think it's a very interesting moment, and is this too early to solve for the election cycle? Maybe it's the right timing and it's just going to take that long. What will it look like to actually change the dynamic in Mexico? Can you? I don't know enough, but it's demonstrative of the America First mindset, right? Is that we're worried about the borders of Ukraine, not the border, our southern border. And it plays perfectly into like what he's trying to build into, and the meme around the presidency, like the energy around the presidency and what he's really popular for.
Well, the geopolitical stuff is very important as well. Because like, that is the thing, is people far focus, I think, too much on the market reciprocity aspect of it. Like, that's actually maybe some of what's in Trump's mind, but like, it's the geopolitics. Because like, the fentanyl issue itself is like, that's a product of other countries' USAID type programs in funneling fentanyl into the US. Like, that's pretty clear to me at this point. Well, because that's what we did in Afghanistan with the poppies, is that we set up these poppies for heroin trade in Iran and Russia as a destabilization effort in Iran and Russia. Like, that was the point of the poppies. And now fentanyl is just the same type of tactic being used on us.
Yeah.
Right. So there's those types of geopolitical gamesmanship stuff that's at play here.
For sure. I think there's a there's a broad consensus on this issue that the Democrats are just falling out of, right? Their response to this was, well, he's being really mean to migrants who are peaceful. And that might be true, but I'm just not sure how compelling that is for the current moment.
Compassion politics,
right?
The toxic empathy stuff is what's killing the country constantly.
Yeah, right. Well, that's the right wing perspective. Yeah. The question is what is the middle, right? How are they going to navigate that?
Well, and that will be the thing, because the optical side of the Democrats on these issues is, if law enforcement on border immigration, ICE stuff goes to a point where it's starting to, where they can do the kids in camps type of stuff.
Uh-huh. Again, they're already doing it.
Which kids in camps are started by under Obama administration, but leave that to the side.
And it avoids the question of what do you do with illegal immigrant children?
But that's also where the mandate of Trump starts to fall apart, because the middle support will start to weaken in those types of moments. Yeah. And so like, on the political side, for the long term, you have to be careful on how far you go with what actually everybody really wants, like what the American public wants. But like, if you go too far too fast, the optics start to hurt, and then it makes all this other stuff weak. Because right now Trump is just like, he can just bludgeon his way through everything right now with how much support he has. So let's move on.
But in the same note, so he also made a claim about death penalties for the murder of police officers. And you know, this is an interesting thing that I think plays well, but you know, I have to criticize the regime on here, because it doesn't. I think it's very short sighted. I think it will play very well. He brought up a widow of a murdered police officer to tell the story.
Stephanie, we're going to make sure that Ryan knows his dad was a true hero, New York's finest, and we're going to get these cold blooded killers and repeat offenders off our streets, and we're going to do it fast. Got to stop it. They get out with 28 arrests. They push people into subway trains. They hit people over the head, back of the head, with baseball bats. We got to get them out of here. I've already signed an executive order requiring a mandatory death penalty for anyone who murders a police officer. And tonight I'm asking Congress to pass that policy into permanent law.
Yeah. And so this is the collateral consequence of Obama saying Congress won't act, so I have a pen and a phone, so I'm going to act with an executive order on DACA.
I forgot about the pen and phone statement.
Right. So like, what's happened, and you know, we've celebrated a lot of the EOs, right? And I think they're symbolically important and good. But the process question that the Democrats are raising on some of these things is it has some founding in law. I'm not exactly sure, and it seems like a weak case, that you can have an executive order to change sentencing guidelines. The separation of powers question there. In general, I oppose mandatory sentencing for quite a few reasons. One, the context really matters, right? So, and imagine this for a moment. My MAGA friends who are, you know, who have some sympathies to this case is, imagine for a moment you have a SWAT raid that goes to the wrong house, which happens too often. These no-knock raids are not, they happen more now than they used to. And someone lawfully carrying believes that their house is being broken into and fires at a police officer and kills him. Does that person deserve a death penalty? Do they deserve any penalty at all? That's what mandatory minimums do. You know, and raising the sentencing minimum up to a death penalty automatically is, I think, a mistake from a policy point of view. Although I agree, you know, his case there is good optics. It is not a wise decision.
Well, and a lot of these things are just backlash from the rampant crime that's existed in the country, and things like the George Floyd case and all of kind of the riots that we had during the Summer of Love. Like, all of these lead up to this point. And that's the thing too, where it's like, I sympathize towards this EO in a sense, but I'm also often skeptical of death penalty as a whole. Like, I'm often skeptical. This is a little bit more clear cut than often other types of death penalties are, just because it's like, if there's definitive proof of murdering a police officer or whatever, like it's a little bit more clear cut, and it's like, okay, these are the expected rules kind of a thing. But there's the processing issue that is where I would have general concerns, and we'll probably see that stuff get hashed out into varying degrees over time, because, you know, these are just executive orders that just get put in and it's like, now do it. Like,
Well, I mean, especially an executive order that then says, now Congress make this legal, right? That's a process question that I don't think is wise. I think it actually creates more of an imperial president than we currently have. And I think that overall has been bad. Even as Congress has been awful, we need to also be protective of the separation of powers doctrine, because it is a uniquely American institution that in net does produce good things. So we have to be very careful about the way we approach that question. So darker moment, but a real problem here. And this is one of the things too, we got to call our balls and strikes here. Right. And this is in baseball analogies. So the Trump administration overall, you can be supportive while saying, hey, I think that particular policy is a bad idea.
Well, and it's also because I feel like the American public in general is probably, I'd be curious in polling on this, is probably at a weird spot with this one just in general, because like there's a rising skepticism of police as a whole, but there's also a need for law and order that is existing there. And there's sort of like an interesting balance that I feel like the American public, like the American psyche, is trying to strike a balance somewhere in there. So like, this is one of those things where there's a interesting conversations that are probably going to be continuing to be had for a period of time.
It's that truck with the Molon Labe and the thin blue line sticker on it, right? It's exactly like that. Exists in the same people, understandably, because they're understandably saying, hey, I think people should be able to have, you know, protect themselves and not have red flag laws and all this BS. And we haven't even covered the Trump Second Amendment stuff. That's a hellscape right now. But we need law and order. He's not wrong to describe that there are people being let out into the streets under a terrible bail process that is not doing a good job about assessing public safety threats and committing additional crimes. So those are anecdotes, but they're real stories, and they're something that actually fires at the public. And we should just
anecdotes there, with how many Soros DAs are everywhere, right?
Well, I'm saying I don't think it's a systemic problem of pushing people in front of trains, although it happens. And that's the terrible thing that it happens, and people getting murdered in the streets of New York and stuff like that's terrible. So doing something about it is critical, but I'm not saying that it's not happening at all, or that it's like a selective bias or something like that. I'm just saying that it isn't as though I'm trying to articulate that there is a that there has to be solutions that we get to that are guaranteeing law and order without going too far and creating additional problems when it comes to separation of powers.
I want to move to my favorite moment of the State of the Union address.
Yes.
some context. He's talking about Ukraine here, but I'm just going to play it out for all its glory.
With no end in sight, the United States has sent hundreds of billions of dollars to support Ukraine's defense with no security, with no anything.
The one-time Democrats clap.
So this is usually be snarkier earlier, right? But he's been very patient.
Do you want to keep it going for another 5 years? Yeah, you would say Pocahontas says yes.
Fires it off. Look at Johnson trying not to smile too big.
And there she is.
He said my name. He said my name.
2,000 people are being killed every single week.
It's so funny too, because I saw, like, you have all these lefty pundits saying it is just disgraceful that he would use a derogatory term like Pocahontas to describe Elizabeth Warren, and the fact checks underneath it, like the community notes and Twitter, are actually, he's not saying it because she isn't Indian, he's saying it because she tried to say she was Indian and it was proven that she's not. Like, those are what the fact checks are.
Got her.
Oh man. Vance just back there grinning, just like, I had to serve with that.
Oh,
lady.
He's doing the Vance glance. It's so funny. And this is coming right off the Zelensky stuff and everything too. So
right. And there was a point where he reads a letter from Zelensky suggesting that Zelensky's willing to negotiate. We don't have to play it, but it just remembering that we had, this actually, just play it without the sound. This is interesting because it's a, it's like a live view sentiment, mm-hmm. and you see how the Republicans are reacting to what he's saying, and how the Democrats, looks what happens to him. So what he's articulating is that Zelensky sent me a letter and it's really great. He's going to get down to negotiating, coming back to the table. And as the independents peak up here.
Yeah, independence just continually rise.
How much the resistance attitude is, I'm not sure, doing Democrats any favor, because this is a winning message amongst the independents. They want to see the Ukraine war end. They don't care about the Donbass.
We have to stop the dying.
Yeah.
People are dying.
And when you heard Scott, when we had him on earlier this week to talk about this, you should check it out. It's a great podcast. Responding directly to Zelensky and all this stuff that happened in this blow up, he makes a claim, and I think it's legit, and this kind of shows it. The American people don't care who controls Eastern Ukraine that much, right? It's like, it's bad that a big country invaded a little country, you know,
they care because they're trained to care about it. Like, it's propaganda at the highest degree of, you got an entire piece of the population, a large piece of the population, to really care about something they did not care about before. Mm-hmm. Like, every time you see that where it's just like all these people had no idea about any of this stuff before, and all of a sudden they instantly really care about it. Like, that's propaganda.
Right.
That's the propaganda at work, and it's a hypnotic pattern that they put on people, right?
This is where our tribe is about now. This is the new religion of our tribe, and we have this new tenet, and it is support Ukraine at all costs, even at the cost of nuclear war.
Well, history didn't exist before that, and Russia did it unprovoked.
Right.
2014, well, I don't know. That was a year that happened, I guess. I don't know.
It's losing message for the Democrats. He also mentioned that he's somehow taking Greenland and, quote, reclaiming the Panama Canal.
I actually saw BlackRock is getting a bunch of purchases in there.
That's how it might happen. So, of course, this is another Trump says, Trump does thing, right? So Trump says, we're going to take back the Panama Canal. What the liberals hear is, I'm going to deploy the 82nd Airborne to carpet bomb Panama, right?
America.
And what it actually is BlackRock buying up Panama. Mm-hmm.
For development, which is also probably what we're going to end up seeing in Gaza in a decade. It's probably what we're going to see. It's just a lot of American developers.
Is that
going
also
in.
Happening in Ukraine, or is that just a rumor?
Once things settle,
I can't remember. I thought I remembered there being a bunch of, was
BlackRock
it BlackRock
had some
like housing developments or something like that. I can't remember.
Yeah. Well, it's probably companies owned by BlackRock. But yeah, exactly. This is the way America's projected power since the Banana Wars, mm-hmm. right? The combination, and if you read Smedley Butler in his book,
War's a Racket,
you can find this case that across much of this time, pre-World War I, there was an effort to expand American corporate power using the State Department. This is another way to do that, using the State Department to push for more corporate control. It's the equivalent of the Belt and Road Initiative, just American style.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure. Do we agree with this, Kyle? I mean, I know you're pro Greenland.
I want to take over Greenland. I'm America.
To me, this triggers a lot of the anti-corporate, State Department corporatism, fascistic sort of elements.
The point I want to make is that we're seeing like a new soft power regime forming, where it's like, and like, you know how Mike Benz always talks about our national champions,
yeah.
right? Like we're in the process of building new, we're kind of utilizing our old national champions, but we're also creating new national champions right now. And some of the new national champions are, we're seeing on the AI front, like, and that's what a lot of this investment stuff is happening. Where it's like, we really want to make sure that those succeed because they also benefit America. And there's like kind of a symbiotic relationship that exists between those corporations and America. And we're also, I think we're beginning to see it on the crypto front. And I think, and I'd be curious because I'm very going to be tuned in to this crypto summit that's going to be happening this afternoon. Yeah. Where he's bringing in all the industry leaders, some that I'm quite surprised by, to be honest.
Interesting.
Coming in, and I think we're in the process of building up a new national champion framework around crypto as well. Mm. So it's just kind of, it's one of those things. It's like, this is how mafias operate. Like, it's kind of like, do we like it? Do we not? Like, to me, it's just, this is real politics.
Is it not, right? So the is this is what is happening. The question is what is our vision for the appropriate role of government? That's the ought, right? Mm-hmm. And the ought here is to what degree do we want to do this? If we don't do this, will China do it all? Right? That's the strongest case on the opposite side, which is if we don't do it, China does it, and then maybe they can weaponize against us at the worst possible time.
Well, and like the Belt and Road Initiative, just think of that as one of China's forms of USAID.
Yeah.
Like it serves the same type of function. But instead of like tranny dancing in Afghanistan, it's like we're building roads
things countries need, right? Yeah. Right? Yeah. Not encouraging atheism in Nepal, yeah. Right? It's we're going to build you a new harbor.
Or fentanyl production in Mexico,
right?
Right? Like that seems pretty clear to me that's Chinese operation, right?
I'm always struggling to separate the hawk disinformation campaign against China with the actual evidentiary standard for that, given that fentanyl is also a medical product.
Who's the guy we had on a long time ago, the fake China threat?
Yeah, Joseph Solins Mullen.
Yeah, yeah. He seemed to think it wasn't very, like...
That the case was weaker than that, I think a lot of people are, the meme suggests.
I look at the intel stuff. I know the history of the poppy fields in Afghanistan. And right. The fentanyl thing, it has all the same types of fingerprints written all over.
Right. It's a pattern that I don't think you could just ignore. But I think it is it's a question about are we actually taking the regime talking points about a giant conspiracy between Canada and Mexico to kill Americans, maybe too on its face.
I don't think it's necessarily, it's more about the destabilization efforts. And it's just like, you just like, this is the thing that all countries do with these types of intel programs. And we'll get into some of the Israeli stuff in the skiff the same stuff. They're the top spies in the world, really.
Sure.
But is that you put like, $50,000 here, $100,000 here, $1 million here, and you just kind of start doing all these things. And there's like long-term visions that operate with. Eventually, this builds up here. You're shifting incentives inside of a foreign country to move. It's sort of like the ESG stuff. I always talk about how that was an intentional mind virus to destabilize financial markets.
Sure,
like it's the same thing. Like that's what people do.
Yeah, and in my case isn't that fentanyl isn't a problem in America. In my case isn't that there isn't a problem happening with the spread of fentanyl and lots of different drugs. Like it's found in like weed and like found in LSD and mushrooms and stuff like that. So that there's something there that makes no sense from any economic analysis you can do. Even black market analysis says, why would you kill your customer? Right? Like, that doesn't make any sense. So what is happening there? I don't know.
Well, it just,
and so intelligence, it's very possible it could be
intelligence and organized
power.
Crime are always intertwined.
Yes.
Like that's, and it's not just, and this is a critique I have of libertarians often, is they often seem to think that it's like only America that does these things.
Oh, no, yeah.
Like everybody's doing it to everybody.
Yeah, right. It's like just, it's just what is your evidence, your standard to believe a thing at that point? It's like, so in getting to this, once again, is American control of Panama so critical? How critical is it? That's a worthy discussion. Was the Chinese ownership of the thing? Because remember when we covered this, I mentioned that the Biden administration failed to do the paperwork, and that's why China got the contract for the canal itself. Mm-hmm. And now they're kind of doing a goalpost shift. It's like, well, actually, there's other Belt and Road Initiative stuff where they're building roads and stuff like that in Panama. It's like, well, okay, but I'm not exactly sure how they're going to use roads in order to control commerce across Panama, right? If the canal is still owned by the authority that we had and they're just maintenancing the authority because we failed to fill out the paperwork.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
there's an element too of like one of the things where I'm glad to see the shift in foreign policy, like I say this all the time, it's much more in our sphere rather than doing all these shenanigans over in Afghanistan and whatnot, is like Americans would benefit greatly to have a better and less corrupt Mexico.
Yes.
That's filled with cartels.
For
that
sure.
would be incredible for America just as a whole to have, because more prosperous nation then, better trade partners, less murders and decapitations on highways, those things are all great. And same with just like Central America, the relationship building going on with Bukele down in El Salvador, blah, 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 all that stuff. I think is like so many problems that exist when it comes to immigration, when it comes to drugs, when it comes to all this stuff are all coming because of just the complete destabilized nature, which America played a part in throughout like the 70s and 80s. Yep.
Check out our monologue on that.
Quite a bit on there.
It's a syllogism, right? It's like, if you're going to project power overseas, then better to project power in ways that directly benefit America, not ways that benefit some other country. It's the if part of that is still at the foundational question. It's like, is this what we should? Should we become a normal country that has normal relationships with our neighbors and doesn't project soft power? Or if it's projecting soft power, it's to counter the negative actions of other countries rather than being used to enrich BlackRock, right? And that corporate profit-making motive to put political pressure onto a country so that you can then dominate them with a corporation is itself the reason why we have the problems we do in immigration across Central America.
Well, and that's where you end up getting a lot of the regulatory capture side and things like that, where you're using these national champions to, and that's where being skeptical of, because that is fascism. Like that is actually fascism.
And to be clear, and so we don't trigger, because the mousetrap problem. Yeah. We're saying everything that happened after about 1890.
We adopted the Mussolini model.
After the Spanish-American War was this. Yeah. So it's every single president after that, with maybe the exception of one or two.
But it's also just like fascism is probably the most real version of the state, because it's like actually just blatantly what the state is in a lot of ways, where you're, because it's the most like mafia like element, and that's all really the state is. Everybody else is kind of pretending to be something that they're not, like every other single form of government. And like this is actually just more blatant, like, no, this is what the government is. It's like they have their private partners, they're working with these, they're using the religious identity of the state and kind of that, the mythology around it, to be able to help their private partners do these things that also advance their goals. Like that is the relationship between government and major international corporations, and always has been. We just kind of lace it with fancy terminology beyond that, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, always has been might be a challenge. If only just because
since the nation state development of kind of how things have operated.
Yeah. So,
but even like in the times of monarchs, like that's kind of just what it is.
So,
like,
well, I mean, it can be. Yeah. Not all monarchs are weighted equal in that. The question is what ought we be, right, at that point? And that ought to be is still lingering there. And I think people have to contend with, Republicans have to contend with, if you're pissed off about BlackRock dominating America, American global finance and pushing ESG, are you not also upset that they're now going to be in charge of Panama? Mm-hmm. you know, and then on top of that, it was United Fruits, the reason why Nicaragua was a basket case for 30 years, hundreds of thousands of people died. And one of the reasons why one of the number one demographics of people illegally immigrating in the Americas is Mexico and Nicaragua. So and we could be there in Panama and someday in the future. And, they, you know, it'd be a shame if no one ever spoke up about that.
Do we want to get into all this tariff stuff? Because I'm looking at the time right now and I'm like, oh, boy, we've covered the State of the Union a lot.
Go like 10 minutes.
We'll go a little long. So Trump did. Then he goes on to declare success on tariffs in a kind of making his case for why they're such they have been going so well. Kind of bridging off this whole Mexico political thing.
Here's a video from the Soto owner.
If you don't make your product in America, however, under the Trump administration, you will pay a tariff, and in some cases, a rather large one. Other countries have used tariffs against us for decades, and now it's our turn to start using them against those other countries. On average, the European Union, China, Brazil, India, Mexico and Canada, have you heard of them? And countless other nations charge us tremendously higher tariffs than we charge them. It's very unfair. India charges us auto tariffs higher than 100%. China's average tariff on our products is twice what we charge them. And South Korea's average tariff is four times higher. Think of that, four times higher. And we give so much help militarily and in so many other ways to South Korea. But that's what happens. This is happening by friend and foe. This system is not fair to the United States and never was. And so on April 2nd, I wanted to make it April 1st, but I didn't want to be accused of April Fool's Day. just one day was cost us a lot of money. But we're going to do it in April. I'm a very superstitious person.
It's interesting. Before we get into the tariff stuff, it's just there's an interesting comment on his demeanor. It's like he's just so different in these types of things.
He's from relaxed.
Every other politician. Like, he's relaxed. He's just doing the thing. He kind of riffs on things. Like, he has his stuff, but he deviates. He weaves.
He weaves. He's weaving.
It's such a unique moment.
Have you heard of them?
Have you heard Canada and Mexico? Have you heard of them?
So we got some interesting graphs here to dive into on exactly what we're talking about when it comes to the Trump tariffs. It's kind of been percolating, but it's always been what he's saying. And now we're getting down to what he's doing, because a lot of these tariffs are now into effect. If you go down a little bit, Kyle, there's I tried to find like a visual, but the best is just laying it out. Okay, so you can see how Canada, Mexico, China all had the announcement, how they were delayed till March. Despite Mexico, you know, apparently in his own speech capitulating on political demands, we still have the implementation of these tariffs at 25% non-energy, 10% energy tariffs for Canada, 25% for Mexico, 10% on China. There's still a lingering threat of a 60% on China, and this doesn't exactly display that very well. What we're looking at when it comes to the import level is the amount of value that is going to be subject to this tariff, and how much they actually contribute. So that what that means, if you go down a little bit, and the same thing with the European Union at 25%, there's different rates for some other areas like autos, when it comes to pharmaceuticals, semiconductors. I think tariffing semiconductors is strange.
Interesting, 25%.
Yeah, it's pretty high. The real question for me, especially when it comes to solving one of the key problems that Donald Trump has to lead to solve, is inflation on housing. And one of our major problems is lumber. For decades, the American government has failed to be able to log our own public lands because of mismanaged forestry, because of the Environmental Protection Act, and, you know, our terrible forest management. So we don't make nearly as much lumber as we used to. We import a lot of it from Canada because they reformed their same processes in the 1990s and now produce a lot of the lumber for North America. So if he wants to solve housing, he cannot tariff wood and get the thing that he's looking for. And that could be some cases that the manufacturer will take that on the nose, and we could get into the economics there. But some of those will be passed on to consumers in America. If you go down a little bit more, keep going. I wanted to get into the economic effects. Yes. So basically what this does is it works on a model, and I'm not sure what the elasticity of the model's assumptions are. Now, what I mean by elasticity is if you're a Canadian, if you're a Canadian producer, do you absorb the tariff in your and therefore reduce your increase your expenses, or do you pass it along to consumers? The elasticity of demand is what will determine that, right? So elasticity is, are there other consumers for your product that you can divert that to and therefore have less product going to America, and therefore the product that does be purchased in America will only be at the far end of the curve, and that those people will then pay more. Does that make sense? So to what degree this is elastic assumptions or not, I didn't have the time to dig into, but we're still looking at, you know, if this model is true, 0.1 less GDP in America from each of these taxes.
You know, something that's interesting too is Trump, I've seen him on multiple occasions telling the press that Americans should be prepared for a short-term pain because of these things.
Yeah.
Like he is softening the blow, which is interesting. Like I would be surprised. I'm actually a little surprised that he's openly saying, he said that at the State of the Union address, mm-hmm. That
he acknowledged that there will be a negative for the first time.
Yeah. Like actually short-term pain, which is common with regime change markets too. Anyways,
yes.
Like regardless of what you're doing, that is a very, like, this is a regime change markets is a thing that is studied in market capital allocation is massive pain in the short term to build a foundation for the future. Mm-hmm. And what everybody's reallocating, we're seeing that happening with markets now. Like everything's just going crazy right now and every single time he announces or talks about tariffs at all is one of the major catalysts of all of the market indicators just going haywire.
Right.
You can't really like I in a lot of ways it's just be patient, not financial advice.
For sure. Yeah, right. I mean, and that's the question, right? Is like I think there's the supporters from the MAGA right are willing to take that on. The question is what are the independents willing to take on, right? The supporters of the MAGA right made a giant stink about 80,000 competitive jobs from H-1B visas. Mm-hmm. But just the hours worked equivalent of jobs from the China tariff could produce 114,000 jobs lost. Mm-hmm. And that's just in the import, not the export. If you go down further, the responding tariffs, which are now being announced and pushed out from the opposition. This is the revenue effects. Yeah, keep going down.
Distributional effects.
That's the lower income as a result.
After tax incomes is interesting.
Though. Yeah. The retaliatory effects. This here we go. Yeah. So as this is when they respond with their own tariffs. So these are exporters. And one of our major exporters are the farmers. Remember last time in 2016, 2017, 2018, there had to be bailouts of farming because of those because of the responding tariffs. It wasn't because of our tariffs that happened. It was because of the responding tariffs from the countries that are being tariffed. Now, he even mentions, like, you know, how the farmers are going to be hurt by this, mm-hmm. you know, and I think a lot of those, and it's not, I think when the left says, like, well, those people voted for Trump, how dumb were they? Yeah. It's more about, like, okay, so we're trying to fix a multifaceted problem here. If you're not, if you're being generous to the Trump and the MAGA right, you're saying, look, short-term loss, long-term gain. Yeah. That assumes that all these things can be made here. And this is the frustrating thing about it. Can you manufacture more in America? Kinda. You can build a data center relatively affordably, but can you build manufacturing where you actually make things, right? Well, what are the barriers there? Well, the barrier there is the EPA. It's the Environmental Protection Act. It's the OSHA requirements. It's the building requirements. It's the giant regulatory problem that we have. Mm-hmm. And I just think, you know, at a minimum, until you've addressed some of those things, you've really kneecapped your ability to actually do the thing he wants to do, which is mm-hmm. reshore manufacturing. And even if we do reshore manufacturing, it's not going to lead a lot more jobs because we automate manufacturing in the United States. We have the technology for it. So what are we going to do here? Like, is it really going to produce the effects that he wants? I'm skeptical because it's just, you look at the economics, and I'm not talking about these graphs. I'm just saying the logic of you know, the actual problems of manufacturing in America that we've had since Nixon, you know, they're substantial.
Yeah.
And he can't change that without a bill.
That's my primary concern with the tariff stuff is, like, I'm open to a lot of the tariff arguments. I've become more open to them over the last couple of years. But a lot of my concerns is, like, I'm seeing that there's these other things that need to be addressed in order for the logic of the tariffs to continue to make sense. And it's exactly what you said. It's like the EPA being really one of the largest ones, but just a lot of the regulatory reform in these agencies as a whole need to be addressed in order for a lot of this stuff to maybe be net positive.
And that's not even
right now. We'll see if that happens.
Yeah. But, and that's not even mentioned in the state level barriers, which are also substantial. And a lot of the states with the biggest populations. So, are you going to see that change? I'm not sure. And if you do, it could be over a time horizon that's damaging to the MAGA movement in the long run. Right. If it takes 8 years to get approval, that means Trump's not president anymore. And the effects of this could already be gone.
Well, it's also just like, how long is short term pain is also another question, because midterms are a problem there. And that makes it even more difficult to get some of these things done.
Well, and to get
that's also, we're trapped in this, like, America is constantly trapped in this election cycle stuff where you can't really fix problems because of election cycles often. Because, like, the problem on a lot of things, economics and markets related, is short-term pain for long-term gain is, like, of just a very common theme.
Uh-huh.
But nobody wants to do the short-term pain thing.
Yeah.
Like, this is
because the election problem.
This is true of interest rate policy. This is true of, like, so many different elements of economics. It's like, sometimes you got to drain the system out a little bit, and which is painful, is often going to be painful in the short run. But then there's the next election to worry about. So it's just like, let's just keep kicking the can down the road for the thing.
Right? Constantly in short-term pain.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mencius Molbug over here. Democracy's problem. I totally get that. Well, and I think, you know, and to be charitable to the MAGA Trump right, you know, there's actually this really interesting Wall Street Journal article that says China's secretly worried Trump will win on trade. Really interesting story. Following Donald Trump's election in November, Xi Jinping, concerned about potential superpower clash reminiscent of the Cold War, instructed his aides to study U.S.-Soviet rivalry, fearing China could face isolation akin to Moscow's as Trump aims to rewire the global trading system that has so far favored China. Trump, leveraging a strong domestic mandate in strategic diplomatic moves like embracing Russia to divide it from China and regaining control over the Panama Canal, seeks to counterbalance Beijing, right? So from a position of strength, while Xi, facing a weakening economy, a power crisis, prepares retaliatory measures and courts U.S. allies to mitigate intensifying the rivalry. So, and this is an interesting, like, subversive sort of, like, narrative, is if elasticity from the China side, from their export markets, if that means Brazil isn't going to take more Chinese exports because we've increased their tariffs and they've increased our tariffs, you know, are they going to have to take it on the nose? And this would suggest that they might actually face a lot of a lack of elasticity for the demand for their products. And that means that they're not going to take that without becoming more isolated. And that's a huge problem for them. So how are they going to navigate? So, interesting moment. It also claims in there that China is claiming that they are on the table and they want it willing to negotiate to keep this trade war from happening, but the Trump administration isn't doing it. So, yeah. The counter tariffs on from Canada and China have imposed already. Canada imposed a 25% tariff on 25% immediate. And up to $125 billion in increased tariffs after 21 days for U.S. goods. And then 100% tariff on Teslas, which I thought was interesting. And definitely more of a media play, right?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Trying to damage Elon specifically. And this is obvious, like Trudeau fitting into the left to mainstream corporate media, you know, strategy of separating Trump from Elon, of punishing Elon specifically. In this. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I used to idolize the guy. CEO of politics.
Yeah.
Interesting. Huh. Yeah, with a lot of this tariff talk, it's going to be patient. Let's wait and see where things are going to go. Because like I have my skepticisms, but I also have my optimisms. Like it's a weird balancing act that exists within a lot of the dialogue here.
Patience has been the theme the last couple of weeks.
Patience has been the theme, yeah, especially with things like the Epstein case and whatnot. Patience.
Big disappointment. So irrelevant there is China's 10 to 15% tariff increases specifically targeted toward agricultural goods, right? Which is a elastic market, right? They can start importing those from other places. Brazil exports a lot of beef. Right, well, they can start getting that from Brazil rather than us, and I think that's gonna hit American farmers on the nose.
Well, that's the thing is like people don't really fully understand the mechanics of this beautiful word tariffs. Yes. Almost as great as love, as Trump would say.
Yeah,
is that a lot of it is like it's trade war using your citizens' wealth as a bludgeoning tool against the other side's citizens' wealth.
Right.
And it's like, okay, who can take the most pain, more pain the longest? That's kind of what tariffs are used for in practical geopolitical sense. Right. So like those are the gambles that like Trump's making various gambles with these tariff plays. And it's just kind of like, we'll see how they turn out. Like it could be long-term net beneficial, but like we gotta wait and see those things. Like,
yeah,
the pain is going to be very real.
It depends on how much you weigh, your risk tolerance and how much you weigh the theory that if we just if this trade balancing is the thing that is making jobs go overseas, or was it automation, or was it the EPA, OSHA, and all the agencies?
In reality, it's probably all of them to varying degrees, right?
Yeah, yeah. And to what degree are you weighing? And that's what I mean by weighing, right? Are you weighing trade as the number one culprit or not? And the populist sentiment looks past our own government's, you know, victimizing us with expert controls over everything that make it impossible to do anything, and looks to China as the core culprit, and that may or may not be true. Well, I think the totality of it, as I weigh it the opposite way, at the end of the day, I weigh it that the EPA is a much bigger barrier to manufacturing America than Chinese, you know, competition.
Although I do remember Trump on the campaign trail saying a story of his first term, where he was talking about his relationship with Shinzo Abe, who was assassinated, a Japanese prime minister, who was kind of like the Trump of Japan. And he said that he had a meeting with Shinzo, and he's just like, hey, you know, like, I'm looking at the numbers, and you guys have been screwing us, like, on the trade side. And he said Shinzo Abe's like, yeah, I was worried about that meeting. What are we going to do about it? Because he's just like, and it just entirely came down to, like, really just bad business deals from previous administrations just getting completely cooked over by other countries. And then Trump is just like looking at the numbers and just like, come on, man, we got to balance it. And then you had this guy who like really liked Trump, Shinzo Abe, who was a good prime minister in Japan, just being like, yeah, I know.
That's one of those things. Yeah, that is interesting. But you know, what is a trade deficit a bad thing? Is the other in question that you that the MAGA right has to contend with. Right? Is that theory right? That if you have a trade deficit, you import more than you export from a country, does that mean we lose something?
But the thing is, it could. But it could also mean not, right? Like,
yeah.
And it depends on the very specifics on various things, right?
Well, I mean, any individual deal for a company overseas selling something could be good or bad.
Yeah.
Right? The question is capital flow going out of America to another country, is that bad? Right? Is when you go to, you know, that mud hut that you like to go to get your coffee, Kyle, you know, I don't know. What's it called in Belgrade?
We don't have to advertise my habits.
Why not? Yeah, it's a great time. I just want to plug them. They make great food. Oh yeah, you're right. We don't, he is single, ladies. So, sorry. So when you go there, you have a trade deficit with them. You give them money and they give you a product. That's what he's measuring when he says the numbers were being screwed over. And I'm not exactly sure that that's actually indeed a problem when you step back and you really look at it, because they have to do something with that money. Mm-hmm. And what do? They buy American goods and they do other stuff and they build stuff and they do all kinds of things.
But they could probably get better deals than what they're otherwise getting, right? Like that's where a lot of this is.
We may be able to use the State Department to force different sorts of deals, but that depends on what you mean by deal, right? Is like forcing did it work in 2016, 2017? Did we increase manufacturing in a real way? You know, I mean, the
entire first administration of the Trump administration was basically a flop for all the reasons that we understand the reasons are, right?
Right. I mean,
it's not even policy reasons. It's deep state reasons.
Right? Well, I think that's true for some things, but I'm not sure that's true on the trade question, right? I mean, did he have, you know, was trade a big enough priority for him that he was actually able to execute the trade policy he wanted?
Yeah.
And it seems to me, I'm not aware of any accusations that he said, hey, we're going to do a tariff here, and it never happened, like it didn't with troops in Syria and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just like my entire point of this is just like,
yeah,
all of the above
right.
are things that need to be fixed. Like, yeah, maybe this is like, I'm not taking a side of like, this is the one specific thing that needs to happen. I'm just like, I think the EPA stuff is very real. All the regulatory agencies are real. I those are problems that need to be fixed. But I also think that probably our geopolitical trade negotiations also need to be fixed. And all of those things, like too many people in all of this conversation are just like, this is the thing. The steel man is Mexico, right?
I mean, them giving us cartel leaders because of a tariff is, that I would see that as more affordable than sending the 81st Air Brigade into Mexico, right? So totally makes sense. It's just this question of trade balance and trying to reshore American manufacturing, and is that actually going to work? Is the question for me at that moment?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and it's one of those things. Is like, I'm open to all sides of the argument on this topic. Like right now, I'm kind of
what I want to see is better debate about it. Right? Yeah, you know, that's the biggest thing.
I want to see.
What is the actual case there? And like I said, there is a case. The elasticity case is there.
Everything's trade-offs. Like, there's just trade-offs on all of these things. And that's the conversation that needs to be had. It's just like, if you're doing one tactic, like, you're often sacrificing something else. And those are the conversations to be had.
And it's a difficult one to have because Trump keeps on saying that this is going to bring in lots of money. But I haven't seen anything that actually indicate that, mm-hmm. right? So, and if you go into there, the revenue part of this, and he claims it's going to bring in trillions of dollars. Not this one, the other one. There we go. And go up. And that question is what kind of revenues is going to be in? Is it enough to eliminate the income tax and all this stuff? Go up a little bit more, and it is to revenue.
Revenue effects?
So what we're looking at here is it's two different models. It's conventional, and then there's the dynamic, which is like how their responding tariffs will result. But if you total up in 2025, we're reaching in the area of, you know, a couple $100 billion mm-hmm. in additional revenue for the federal government. We're an order of magnitude away, not an order of magnitude, but we're about 10x away from where we need to be in order for it to make up for tax cuts. Mm. So I think the ambition is great. But is the execution going to be there? And this is another one of those Trump,
the
what
execution
he says
thing is,
versus what he does.
Well, and that's the dynamic, is the execution requires a lot of people to make the correct plays, and we'll see how that goes, right?
Yeah.
Like, those things are kind of, we need to wait and see on those
and
things.
What is the status of the actual economics? Mm-hmm. What is the true elasticity? That's something that's discovered, not known. Mm-hmm. So we'll find out.
Yeah, like a lot of these things are guts and gambles.
Yeah, at the end of the day,
gut feels, right?
To be clear, I you know, Donald Trump was thoroughly spoken in favor of for me in the last election cycle, because war with Russia was the number one issue in my mind. I'll take a trade war over a nuclear war any day. Mm-hmm. Easy decision on my part. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be saying, hey, is this going to work?
I don't know. Flip a coin.
So another EO that happened is the executive order establishing a Bitcoin strategic reserve and digital asset stockpile, Kyle.
Yeah, I'll do a quick update on this because, as the resident crypto guy, there was an executive order actually here. Let me just pull up the executive order. And this happened last night. He signed this alongside the Irish American Heritage Month.
Yeah.
It was like this and
dude,
that. Like,
so
two
up
big,
right
two
now.
Big things right
just,
now.
Just winning.
Just winning. So there's two things that are happening with this, and I'm seeing people online are very they're not understanding what's actually happening with this, which is annoying. Even in the crypto,
they're going
to
buy a bunch of crypto and crypto dollar go up, right?
That's not what's happening.
Oh, man.
Well, maybe on the Bitcoin side.
What about my holds, buddy?
My gains.
What about my gains?
So Trump, this afternoon, at the time of recording this, it'll have happened before this episode comes out, is he's having a big crypto summit with all of the major industry leaders, a lot of the major industry leaders, some of who I'm surprised are being there. Just because of various reasons. But what this executive order itself does, and it was kind of brought in by David Sachs, who's the crypto czar, crypto and AI czar, is that it establishes two things, and they're separate things. People are combining them, these in their mind, and they're not to be combined, is that there's a Bitcoin strategic reserve, which was a campaign promise that he made to the libertarians and the Bitcoin conference, et cetera.
Promises fulfilled.
Yeah, and it's going to begin with the seized Bitcoin from illegal activities that has been seized, which is actually
Roger
a
Veers.
Lot.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, maybe.
It's a lot of Bitcoin cash, guys.
which is 198,109 Bitcoin. This actually makes the
perfect.
Basically, the United States government and Michael Saylor and Satoshi are the biggest holders of Bitcoin in the world. Basically,
damn.
So we can pay our debt.
Well, and what it adds to that is that it's also giving the government, the working group is going to be devising strategies to continue to accumulate Bitcoin in budget neutral manners. And they're trying to devise more and more strategies. And a lot of people like Michael Saylor are kind of coming on board with devising those strategies. Mm-hmm. Michael Saylor is kind of the famous Bitcoin guy from MicroStrategies.
Yeah. Early adopter.
Yeah. No, late adopter. Like, we're talking, this is COVID era when he comes in. But now he's one of the largest.
I'm confusing
holders.
Him with someone else.
Yeah. No, Michael Saylor is like there is no second best if you've ever seen those memes. But then there's also a digital asset stockpile, which is where people got very confused because he made tweets about this beforehand and people were confused of like, are these coins being added to the strategic reserve? Uh-huh. They're not. And people are still thinking that they are, which is Ethereum, Solana, Cardano, and Ripple are in those stockpiles. And the intention is not to continue to accumulate those. Those are assets that the government already has and they want to just hold them for now. Hmm. They don't want to, they're not devising a specific strategy to continue to accumulate more of those. They're just, we have these because of criminal activities and things like that. And we are just going to continue to hold them for now. Mm. And we might do something with them later, but as of right now, we are recognizing these as American made assets. And we're just going to hold these in a stockpile.
Iron hands from the federal government. Yeah. We got it.
We are diamonds in this.
One of the things I thought was interesting was Sachs talking about in a tweet, I don't think I put it in there, is he says, over the past decade, the federal government sold approximately 195,000 Bitcoin for proceeds of $366 million. If the government held that much Bitcoin, it would be worth $17 billion today. That's how much it costs American taxpayers not having a long-term strategy. That is crazy.
Well, that's actually a common thing of like, if you've been in crypto, you've always recognized, you're like, oh, fuck, another government selling on us. Yeah. Like, and it, all of a sudden it just like, it hurts the market because now there's all this new fresh liquidity coming in and it'll be like the Silk Road dollars where it's Germany is selling a bunch of Silk Road Bitcoin confiscated or like, the United States government is, because so much Bitcoin was confiscated in the Silk Road stuff, Ross Ulbricht, et cetera, right? Who Trump recently pardoned. Actually, Thomas Massie brought Ross Ulbricht to be a participant.
A guest at the
State of the Union address. Yeah. So it's much more of this. And this is the thing, is there are bills being passed through Congress led by Cynthia Loomis of Wyoming, which is devising strategies for the accumulation of eventually 1 million Bitcoin. Because right now the government's at like 200,000. Mm. So this is kind of where the current status of crypto is. But the summit is happening right now, and who knows? There's rumors going on. These are just rumors. I don't know. But there's rumors about zero capital gains tax being announced at the summit on Bitcoin.
Let it happen.
Things like that. Right?
Oh, God, let it happen.
Is this going to be, just because I don't understand crypto, so this might sound really stupid, is this going to be like the equivalent of storing gold in Fort Knox, all this Bitcoin?
Yes. That's actually when David Sachs presented the executive order to be signed in the Oval Office, he actually said that the point of this is to create a digital Fort Knox.
Okay.
That is exact. Those were the exact words that they used.
I feel wicked spot now.
Those were the exact words that they used, is digital Fort Knox.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Wow.
So.
Well, that's encouraging for the crypto guys. Yeah. 0% capital gains would be so awesome.
Well, it's also, it's like, there's some rumors going around and I'm seeing, cause I know various people that are in the ins and outs and part of various mutual like asset management firms that are kind of involved in these conversations with these people and the ETFs and all of that stuff. There are rumors going around of very much a talk of a blockchain based replacement of SWIFT. Mm. on the American side.
Right. Which, and SWIFT is the international payments system. That's the payment rails for international payments.
Yeah. So there's an infrastructure thing that's happening right now. Right. It's like we're laying out the foundations for the future of finance, American led.
So my conspiracy brain's saying, that's just central bank digital currency with extra steps, Kyle. Why is that wrong?
It could be. It's kind of what Whitney Webb says. Mm. She kind of makes those comments. And it's interesting because we see for the first time ever, the Tether CEO is in D.C. for this summit. And Tether is...
I'm kidding.
Tether is a stable coin that's pegged to the U.S. dollar, but there's always been conspiracies around Tether.
Yeah.
About potential CIA connections, et cetera, all this type of stuff. So the world is moving into interesting directions. We'll see where all this stuff is going.
And everything's a psyop.
It's much like crypto in my mind is a lot like AI. The problem is the main attack vectors on it are social engineering. They're not the technology itself. The technology can be used for good or bad. Mm-hmm. And so we got to be very clear and just railing against, tech oligarchs and stuff like that's not useful. Yeah. The world is moving and advancing on technology. We don't want to be just complete Luddites about this, but we want to take and steer the technology in the proper directions with the ought questions, right?
Yeah.
That's my opinion on where all this crypto stuff is, right?
Yeah. Well, I tackle the regulatory state first, right? If you're worried about tech oligarchy, right? If you don't want any hierarchy at all, you know, go join a commune.
Actually, what's interesting, Tucker Carlson interviewed SBF from Sam Bankman-Fried from prison yesterday.
Joe said on the group chat that it was like really good.
He wasn't so Adderall brain. I just saw clips of it. I haven't watched the whole thing yet, It's just like, interesting. He's in a cell with P. Diddy.
In a cell block.
He's in a unit with P. Diddy.
Say, that sounds terrible
and
for him.
His exact
Rough
friend,
Riders.
Tucker asked him. I saw the clip. It's so funny because it was like phrasing SBF. He asked him. He's just like, so are you like friends with P. Diddy? How is he in prison? And he's just like, he's been very. What was the words? It was just like the words were like he's been very kind to me, and. But I've only seen a little piece of him in prison. And you're just like...
Are we not saying phrasing anymore?
What's the baby oil supply in prison?
everybody's putting the like quotations on kind to me. I get little peace in prison.
Oh God.
He's been gentle.
Yikes. All right. Well, but that's the show.
Yeah.
Thanks guys for watching. Thanks for hanging out with us, and we'll catch you guys next time.
Yep. Peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember,
that was a nice out.
I was like, there's no going up from there. That's a good high point to end it on. That was
hilarious. That's exactly it. Yep.